talking last time about, well, the life cycle, and I was commenting on the substantial amount of vacation time which workers have, which drives a lot of economic decisions. The value of a second home, a mountain hut, a cottage becomes greater when one has, even in one's beginning work years, 4 weeks of paid vacation, which escalates to 6 or perhaps more, quite different than in the United States. And I was commenting upon the lack, the narrow gap between the take-home salaries of CEOs and folks on the line. Let me make one more workplace observation. When the Labor Party came in 3 years ago after a sojourn in which the bourgeois coalition had been in power in Norway, they pulled a sneak attack, which they had done their homework. And they persuaded their partners in the coalition to enact a bill which, I like to say, get this, folks, is this Garden of Eden or is this the nanny nations again? A bill in which privately held companies, which are traded on the public market, on the big board, must have 4 years to move to having a gender composition in their boards of directors in which neither gender had fewer than 40% of the membership of the board. And Labor argued that though Norway, to repeat what I've said, has majorities of women in most sectors, from the parliament to most of the professions. Corporate boards were another matter. And the point of view is of labor is that as long as the boards are composed of, I'm going to guess, 85% men, and men who are themselves corporate in background, there will not be social change. Now, this is a classic Labor Party point of view, and it just plowed through before anyone knew what was coming. And so there has been a very interesting flurry in Norway to find women who might have these aspirations. I mean, this is filling a lot of seats to ease out the men who have been on the boards, whether on terms or simply serving on and on and on. Women have been reported in the Norwegian press, some women serving on 2 or 3 corporate boards, obviously a very heady number. But the intent of this is that the new influx of women will represent those who are not members of the elites. I'll use as an anecdote, I have a friend who has recently retired as principal of a middle school in a town on the western coast of Norway, where there is a major furniture manufacturing firm. And the poobahs at the firm reasoned, here is someone who would really enhance our community relationships, who could be of great value to us. And they invited her to the board. And she said, well, I will consider this, but let me be clear. if you think that I'm going to be the kind of person who's going to be concerned about daycare, your kind of typical women's issues or meet the community smorgasbords or something like this, that's not what I want to do. I want to be on the investment committee for the corporation. I understand that that the senior members of the board travel rather frequently to Thailand, for example, to negotiate for, is it teak or bamboo or something like this. I want to know more about these things. I want to be informed. In other words, I want to be on the hard side of the corporate board, and she is. And she's doing her homework, I have no doubt. And it's the dust is just settling now. This year, it all has to be in effect, and I believe it is. Meanwhile, this is exactly what gives the conservatives conniptions. They're saying boards have to serve on the basis of their expertise. We are private companies. This is government meddling gone run amok. And they fought it bitterly, but they did not succeed. Now I have read that this is sort of, there's a lot of talk about this in the water, and I think I've read that both in France and in Poland, the labor majorities, if indeed France has a labor majority, I forget now, are intent upon just such a reform. Well, how would that play in the U.S.? How would it play with you? Yeah.
How many years have they been doing this? Did you say 4 years?
I think they were given only 4 years, and this is the witching hour as we speak. Their boards now, and they could not simply expand their boards and think of the mathematics of that one, to go from, let's say, 15% female on a 24-member board to get to 40%, not to mention 50. You have to have the Belgian Parliament size room. Well, any thoughts? Yeah. I'll move on, if you'll please accept the pace, and because I said in the plan for this course that we would talk about medical care, and I just am extracting a few vignettes here, which I think have a social policy issue. In the Nordic countries, something that is not a goal is the prolongation of life expectancy. The philosophy here is really, if the average life expectancy, not an easy figure to come to, mean is 86, and through highly expensive resuscitation and 24/7 nursing care, one could move that to 86.4, what have we done? So the Nordic countries, which are spending, to take the most dramatic example, in Finland, about 5% of the gross national product of Finland goes to healthcare, versus our about 15%, I believe. In other words, the Finns deliver their health care for about one-third of what we do if measured by percentage of product. The Nordic health care system is saying we can achieve our greatest successes by decreasing infant mortality, which indeed may be so low that it simply can't go any lower. I mean, there will be losses in infancy. The same comment could be made about maternal mortality, the death of the mother in childbirth or in the first week of a baby's life. But it is, the emphasis is at that end of the life cycle rather than intensifying the care for the elderly. Now, this is all very nice, unless you are just celebrated your 89th birthday, and you may not find it so much so. I could go on and on with it, but let me use that as an example. Let me take as another point. Yes, there is rationing. Triage is the dominating management scheme. When one comes into the clinic, when one comes into the hospital, there is that one third where the data, where data-based evidence would say can be resuscitated and improved. There is one third who will be put on a wait list, but will probably get medical care. They are in the great gray middle. And one third or so who really will not get medical care unless there is some sort of emergency or there is a likelihood that the providing of that medical care would provide data, research-based evidence in controlled trials for medical scientists to use. Now, I've laid it out a little too boldly, but that is basically, it seems to me, how the healthcare systems, and I was talking about Norway, and I really wanted to focus, and I think I'm focusing now more upon Finland. Not everyone can get.
On what basis?
On
what basis were they denied the health care?
On what basis? That it is not essential to continuing life, that it is more cosmetic or elective would be one basis, or another, that the patient's situation is too hopeless to justify the evidence. I mean, if someone is in is 90 and having great hip and knee problems, I would suspect that the triage nurse, the admitting officer, would say no, or go home and wait, and if we have an opening, we'll call you. And I think the outcome here is, let me go with your question next.
Well, I was wondering if we had some statistics on the infant mortality in the Nordic countries compared with here, and indeed on length of life.
I didn't bring them, so I don't dare
guess
out numbers, but there are numbers.
It's much higher in the U.S.
We,
much higher.
I mean, for infant mortality, it's much less.
We in the U.S. are in the overall. We do not have a good position or ranking among industrialized societies on infant mortality. It is, again, perhaps almost as low as it's going to go in the Nordic countries. Life expectancy, you can't budget much. You know, to keep people, again, I was, whatever number I used, if you've got an average of 86, it is a Herculean thing to think that you could increase the average from 86 to even 86 and a half. Mm-hmm. It doesn't much budge, and I don't think there would be much difference between the U.S. and the Nordic countries. My brand of, I threw at students in good old sociology 301 was this: don't really give a hoot about average life expectancy boot about is how many young people are living. If we get young people into their 40s and 50s, we will have high average life expectancy, that which Rwanda cannot do. Medical care, somewhat more known. The government budget for medical care all is housed in the, we'll call it in Helsinki. It's in the national ministry, which doles it out to district hospitals, and the district hospitals dole it out to their auxiliary clinics, and tend to have quite a bit of freedom in how they use it. The central government, Helsinki, pays for the construction of facilities, but there's a good deal of local autonomy about how the medical dollars are administered. But this much I want to drive home because of all the discussion of Obamacare, etc. in the US. If I understand what is meant by socialism, which I always thought meant government ownership of the means of production, the municipal liquor store in my hometown was the most socialistic thing I ever heard of, and the conservatives thought it was a great idea. That's socialism. But I don't see that in the Nordic countries. You select your care provider, that person is not paid a government salary. It's not like the VA hospital or Walter Reed or the United States Public Health Service, where you are a government employee. Those medical personnel who can attract a practice of following will earn more, but the bill, they will not send the bill, is the only way I know how to put it. The hospital computes, and again, this is important because of all the things I have heard said about what's going on over there. The hospital will insist upon a patient's investing a certain amount in her own health care. The percentages will vary by her income and by the services that she requires. But one must pay something. The downside of that is that the hospital system has to maintain an accounts receivable department, which is always expensive, as we well know. But it's nothing like what we have in the United States. But once that is satisfied, That's it. It's paid. It's a single payer, and it's administered by the government, not by private companies. No, so far as I can tell, in all the Nordic countries, if you feel you want more, you can buy more. I mean, whatever we want in the way of insurances, we can get. I don't know if it's Lloyd's of London or who we go to, and they will find a way that we could have a private backup, a bridge, but I think not many are doing that. Does this give the flavor? Am I getting to the?
Yes.
I know this is a paramount concern in the U.S.
You were making some comparison to Obamacare, or maybe it was just the socialist comment that followed that.
Well, I didn't organize it that way, but I would say in what we will have in the United States, of course, is that we will choose private vendors, which private vendor we want to pay for our health care. Theirs is a single pay system, which again can be supplemented. In Finland, special care that assures that small children who wake up in the night with earache and have a mother who works full time, that mother can know that she can get the child right into a pediatrician. But that's a kind of a small blip on the large landscape. It is, so I think it is put somewhat different than the Canadian system. income is dependent upon how many choose her. And now I'm just repeating myself.
Yes, so David. Question, David.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So you're saying that, well, first question.
Will you beller right there?
First question.
Yeah.
Is the healthcare profession in the Scandinavian, or in the Nordic countries, considered more of a public service as opposed to how American medical professionals view their profession? Do they see it more as a public service as opposed to a career or occupation? More service-driven as opposed to dollar-driven?
Well, I think it's more of the latter. I mean, I don't know that it's... If I'm following you, you mean a humanitarian project in... are you kind of hinting one shouldn't get rich at it, or...?
No, I'm asking what the perspective of doctors that are there now. I mean, do they view their profession more as a public service, or are they... Do they tend to the American model of, we're going to do this because we can get rich, because it pays well, but I mean, does it lean more that way?
I think it's more the latter. I don't see this as more the latter, but I want to modify that. I don't think anyone in the Nordic countries expects that they can get rich.
Right.
Because the graduated tax rate, the income tax rate, is steeply graduated,
so
that would take care of that. So
yeah, because you mentioned the difference in the disparity, like corporately.
I just want to. I'm trying to say I don't think that this is a is the medical doctor's version of Florence Nightingale or anything like that. I don't think people are. The practitioners are sentimental about it. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. In the Nordic countries, is it as expensive for a person to become educated and become a doctor as it is here? Because here it's very expensive by the time they've gotten through graduate school and residencies and all of this. It's very expensive.
Yes, and to get ahead a little bit, I'll just say it costs nothing.
Yes, yeah, I was going to say,
tuition. If you are admitted to a medical faculty in a Nordic country, there's no such thing as tuition. And the subsidization, the room and board, and the modest salaries of which people who are in residency earn is probably like here. Paying for education is not comprehensible in the Nordic countries. Let me go on. In life cycle, we've got a lot of case studies here. The elderly, I would say, over and over, permeating the whole philosophical base for the care of older people is the concept: only as last resort should people leave their homes. That it is much more effective, and I think this is data-based evidence, that people receive home health care as long as possible. And quite incidentally, much of that home health care is being delivered by members of the new flow of immigrants, the political exile liberal groups, the nurse or the orderly that comes to your home may well be a Kosovar, something like that. People who are often from countries where caring for one's own is well understood, but there have to be. Gradation of nursing homes from intermediate care to skilled care, but it is thought of more as a last resort. And again, in triage, admission to the correct term for nursing home, but
long-term care,
probably very carefully controlled at the admission end. And so we have elderly more often at home. I put on the board because I think, again, my interest is not in public policy about the huge things in life, like whether offenders should be imprisoned or something like that. It's in rather small things, but here's an example. I think Garden of Eden. I'm trying to say neutral. In Denmark, for a very, very long time, a central concept for the elderly in that good soil and more moderate winters is gardening. In the United States, in World War II, we developed a plan called Victory Gardens. It's very much that. If you look out the window of your tram in Copenhagen, in blighted areas which have been sitting with, you know, rusted machinery and that sort of thing, you'll see not that now, but the little plots, the potting sheds, the place where people keep their tools, that sort of thing, and it is viewed as a important therapeutic means as well as a source of healthy food, and it's very much a part of the Danish culture. Norway is rock, and rock is Norway, so it wouldn't work up there so well. But it's very prevalent. So, but I'm just skirting around the issue. But I think that you've got some great concern for humanitarian treatment of the elderly. I might say too that in public policy planning for the elderly, who now we will assume are largely in their homes, is a great emphasis that they be out and be active in voluntary associations, clubs, societies, all the things that create one of my favorite concepts, the building of social capital. Mm-hmm. It's my day to bring hot dish. It's you know, on and on and on, which keeps more people more spirited longer. Yeah.
The nursing homes and then also the home health care, is that paid for by the state?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's not the family or insurance?
No, not the family, not insurance. But again, and this is quite expensive when you say everybody should pay a little something, because somebody's got to keep track of all those little somethings to be sure. I think people have to pay a little bit.
But it's not like you have to sell your house.
No.
But are not the taxes then a lot higher?
We'll in fact, we're going to do it. We're going to get to the taxes. Let me now go into the advertised features of the day for round five. We had talked about education for children, and I'm going to move on beyond that now to say that children who start school at 6 and have an elementary school experience that we talked about for 6 years will go to a middle school with a common curriculum. They will call them seventh graders, all take about the same things. And that middle school will serve as a conveyor to those who want a secondary school experience, which will prepare them for university, or whether they want a vocational school experience. So at 10th grade, There's a splitting of the ways. But the assumption is that the middle school was sufficiently rigorous that all children in these countries have had a core of common knowledge and agreed upon reading lists, literature, and mathematics and so forth. Okay. Now, to take the secondary school, traumatic changes. I'll go to what was then. When I first lived in Norway, I guess I was horrified in a way by the aristocratic concepts of the secondary school, which used the German word, the Gymnasium. The teachers in the Gymnasium were called lecturers, and they were prepared in the university system in those countries. Elementary teachers, as we mentioned last time, having been prepared in normal schools, in three-year programs. Children, when the lector entered the classroom in the gymnasium, the children stood up for her, and at the end, she was the first one to leave, and that sort of thing. And the gymnasium did not provide these young people with much of anything in the way of measurement of how well they were doing. They had almost no examinations because the focus was upon the monster at the end called Studentexamen in Sweden, Examen Artium in Norway and Denmark, in which for several days the candidates for graduation wrote essays. The examinations were prepared by outside officials, and their examinations were read by outside officials. The teacher was not involved. The teacher should, it was thought that this would be a bias, even if one didn't give one's name and that sort of thing. It was a very expensive system, and it was a heartbreaking system, I think. It took forever. Let's say, hypothetically, the last 2 weeks of May, the seniors were writing their examinations. And then, because they were shipped to readers in Finland or who knows where, it took another 2-3 weeks. Well, and we know what it is to be 18 years old and have that anxiety. We're just going crazy. And when the examinations in the Nordic countries were returned, the scores were posted. And I think it was something like 50% of the candidates passed. And the Labour Party hated it. You see, who passed? Those who had the advantages of upper middle class background, of deferred gratification, who were taught from the get-go that it's a long, long road, and who didn't need as much instant feedback. And secondary education across the Nordic area has changed a great deal. It looks now much more like the United States. We have been the model. We have been the gold standard, in the sense that that the prevailing view now is kids learn more, assimilate more, if they are tested frequently, so they know where they're at. So there still is the master examination at the end, but it has nothing of the potency or IQ generate sphere. A very high percentage of the gymnasium pupils, every one down below the level of university is called a pupil. You're not a student until you go to the university. An extraordinary percentage pass, and the government ministries will find seats for them in the universities of their country, or negotiate whereby they may go to a university in another Nordic country. And so, and to take the secondary school just a little bit further, students select a line, a major. It might be information science, it might be natural science, it might be linguistics, so that they will have an emphasis in the secondary school, somewhat like the collegiate major in the United States. But they will also have a core. And the Nordic countries argue that their students coming out of secondary schools have achieved a liberal arts foundation comparable to our students after collegiate study, which we can debate, but it's changed a great deal. And the democratization of the classroom has changed. Pupils are apt to call their lecturer by her first name, that kind of thing. You're just simply more casual and less fearful. But to go back to what was then, again, in egalitarian societies, it was so interesting to me that when the scores were posted, those who passed their qualifying examination for university wore hats. The Finns wore a white hat, the Swedes a blue hat, the Norwegians a red hat, that sort of thing. And they were the cocks of the walk. They closed the bars, and they partied in Oahu and planned their now they were students, their student trip, and took night shifts to Hamburg and that sort of thing for a few days. But stop and think, for that 50% of those 19-year-olds who didn't pass, what that was. It was a nail in the coffin, as I see it. And I must say, I think that this has been a great reform. Thanks be to labor.
When did that happen, David?
Yes, sir.
When did they make that change?
I'm sorry.
When did they make the change so that that not just 50% passed and it was more liberal?
And when did it change?
Yeah.
Oh, I think, we say in education, we call so many things a Vietnam War period.
Uh-huh.
I would think in the late 60s,
oh, okay.
Or early 70s, where there were a lot of reforms for better and for worse.
Yes.
So if you were one of those students that didn't pass, what happened then?
Well, that's a very good question.
You weren't on
vocation. That's a very good question. You're a young man in Oulu in Finland. Do you go back to secondary school and join the class behind you? Kind of like the kid who flunked fourth grade. In our school system. So the risks there of stigma and loss of face are there, but it's really, I think, the only way that, either you...
So they would try again.
You go for the ring once again, or you move into vocational education and have a skilled trade. Well, what I'm trying to say is it was traumatic. After secondary school, we get another hiatus. In all the Nordic countries, all men are drafted. It is not It is not voluntary. They're the military of all, whether they come out of secondary school or whether they've been working, at age 19, they give approximately a year to the military. Where, I think anyone would admit, it's an absolutely impossible issue for the military side, the Ministry of Military Affairs. What in heavens do you do with all these people? You know, they bring different degrees of skill and commitment, and it's not like training them for warfare, after all. But men, and it's only men, they will, many will be assigned to work as orderlies in mental hospitals or nursing homes or that sort of thing. One thing for sure they all have in common is that they will do winter maneuvers up in the north, and there lurks not a man who has not said, I'll never sleep in a tent, I've given my life from that. But it's a rather chaotic system, and yet these are the egalitarian ethos of these societies says that military should not be staffed by volunteers. It should be a draft. Only it is one of our opportunities to bring together our citizenry, regardless of social class and background. So by this time, in these times, men are about 19 years old when they finish their military training. Women often step out as well right after their secondary school education. It's thought to be a very wise strategy for a young woman to be a nanny or an au pair, something like this in another country, to go to Italy, live with a family, learn Italian, add another language to the quiver, which probably is three foreign languages long already. So that it's approximately at age 19 that people come together for many to enter university study. And in university study in the Nordic countries, you go right into medicine, theology, law, etc. That is to say, you're younger when you come out. You're not sure if your dentist shaves yet, so to speak. Again, they would say that they've had their rigorous common learning experience in the secondary school. Now, many do not go into the kind of profession I've talked about. They want an academic program, and so they study humanities or science. Well, back when, and that's really only about 10 years ago, very many of the students stayed and stayed and stayed in the university, pragmatically, without tuition, and with student loans for room and board running at about 3%, you really couldn't afford not to take one out. And I'm speaking now of those who are following an academic course, not a professional course. I'm not speaking of the law students now, or the engineering students, but those who are in the behavioral sciences, a broad tent, that kind of thing. They stayed and stayed because there was so little in their education which told them where they were at. They didn't know when they should sit for their examinations. It was very nerve-wracking and very inefficient. And Europe, and meanwhile, they're on the public dole. And they are not tax-paying, contributing members of the labor force. And that has changed, and rather recently. And the complexities are bewildering. The set of agreements for all the member countries called the Bologna, a university in Italy where the papers were signed for this. So that across Europe now and recently, a university student has 3 years to take what we would call the bachelor's degree, 120 units, something like 120 semester credits. Remember when? So they have a very intensive 6 semesters, and if they go beyond that, they lose all kinds of eligibility on their loans and that sort of thing. And the Bologna pattern is a 3-year baccalaureate followed by 2-year master's degrees, and the jury's still out. The smoke has not cleared, but it looks to people as though the Nordic students are electing to have 2 masters and a baccalaureate. So they are 3 plus 2 plus 2, 7 years in study. So really, if they follow that pattern, a little bit more than their American counterparts.
Question?
Yeah.
You mentioned about the uniform education in secondary, so that these 3-year degrees that they're going for, bachelor's, are not liberal arts degrees. They're more focused, almost like a technical, only the technical subjects. I know people that have gone to school in Europe and they say, oh, we didn't take sociology or any of that stuff. We just took, math or whatever they did.
Okay, you're interested in the natural sciences. Biology. Your 3-year baccalaureate would be in entirely biology or supporting prerequisites. I mean, no doubt the biology faculty requires that one have chemistry and that kind of thing. But no, you don't go ranging around looking for a general education to go along with your major emphasis. So again, in secondary school, you've had a line. Linguistics, for example, though you have a wide distribution. You have everybody has science and humanities, some behavior, some social science. In university, you're entirely focused. Another aspect of education in the Nordic countries, and I'll check the scene quite a bit. The Danish theologian Grundtvig will be remembered for his warm, rich, and broad theology. But he will also be remembered as the architect of a movement that he founded called the Folk High School. And the concept was that there needed to be a place in the educational scheme where people of any age could go off somewhere for a half a year or a year and pursue their own interests. No examinations, no credits, simply enrichment. And for many midlife people who had had only a minimal formal education, the folk high schools became very important to them. When one is, for example, caught between jobs or in widowhood or in retirement, the chance to go, and the folk high schools, which started in Denmark and have spread like dandelions all across the Nordic countries, will have an emphasis. I know of one where a young friend, I suppose then around 22, spent a year at a winter survival folk high school, a Another one may emphasize weaving or glassmaking or religious studies, etc. So there is a liberal education in the Nordic countries for those who wish to take available to it, which is entirely independent of the university system. Yes.
So, like in the United States, a lot of people, you know, go into the workforce and then later on go back and get degrees and things like that. Do they have a system for night school or getting school, you know, degrees or other types of things? Or do they basically, once you get past that 3 and 2, unless you took that opportunity when you're young, you don't have that? You know what I'm saying? Like night community college, adult education, professional studies, that sort of thing.
To go in later.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And where at first it was shocking for the aristocracy universities, as I would call them, the University of Helsinki, for example, is thought to be, or Uppsala, or Lund in the two Swedish universities, that they sort of expected that everyone was fresh out of the student examination with high scores. Again, pardon my bias, but that has been the value of strong labor parties. They said there has to be a place in our system of university education for people who lack traditional credentials. The mid-career woman who was denied that opportunity that her brothers might have had, for example. So the democratization has become very great. But it wasn't always so, that's what I want to say. No, to end at 7:15, Vespers are at 7:30. May I ask for 7 minutes?
Yes.
So that I've gotten through this. I think as we have come together at Holden Village and this rich emphasis upon worship and so forth, it's certainly appropriate that we say something about religion in the Nordic countries. I feel shabby, you know, taking important subjects and asking for 7 minutes for them. a couple
7 minutes is better than none.
Yeah. If one is in a Danish or Swedish or Norwegian, Danish, I'll call it market town, a town of some size, that sort of thing. First of all, the religious architectural profile is likely to be this. The big church, the state church, the pastor of the state church, a government employee, represented by a union who negotiates for all the pastors of the state church in terms of their salary and their benefits and that kind of thing. Serving a parish that might be very extensive in geographic area. Adjoining that church will likely be something that is often called the prayer house. It is a place where the pastors of the state church traditionally have not been welcome. It has been a place where the laity prevail, and for religious organizations of one sort or another, in each of these countries there have been strong lay religious movements, and the prayer house is a response to this. Now, numbers, well, it's hard as anything to calculate things like this, but I think that there has never been in modern times an equation perceived by people in the Nordic countries between Christian faith and going to church. The church is simply not viewed or defined as a place where you really should go. I mean, you know, our Sunday really isn't Sunday unless it is defined as an institution where the infant is baptized and where the teenager is confirmed, and quite likely, because the funeral home industry is not as developed there, where the dead shall be buried. Attendance, to be sure, is very, very small. It's very, very low. I have so many times I can't count them. Had someone come back to me and say, Dave, it isn't at all like that. We were visiting our relatives in Denmark, and the church was just packed. And I love to say, well, now, how many pews were there in the church? 20. And how many do you think fit into a pew? Six. Okay, 120 were there. And what was the size of the population of the parish? Well, one would not know that, likely, but I think it would almost certainly accept in very isolated areas, be 20, 30,000 people. My point is critical thinking. I've described so briefly a state church structure. Add to that in all of the countries, perhaps most particularly in Sweden, that one will see in a market town a small free church, as it's called. Probably very close to, in practice and in theology, to the Mission Covenant Church in North America. There will be a very small, very likely, a small Methodist community, a small Baptist community, and a small but perhaps rather elite Roman Catholic community. And there, the participation in worship, again, when people are part of religious minorities, they may be more intense. So there is a religious scene, and now being augmented all across Sweden, Denmark, and Norway with the mosques. Some geographer of religion in Norway who had research assistants who helped count people who walked through the doors of houses of worship calculated that more people in Norway in a given week enter the principal mosque in Oslo than all the Christian churches in all of Norway. So that, you know, things are changing. And forgive me, I forgot to mention that there will likely be a Salvation Army organization, and that there will be a Pentecostal, a small Pentecostal church. And again, but these will be rather intense in their religious fervor. Now, in Sweden, and I alluded to this last time, we have a very major public policy statement. Just very recently, the Swedish government determined to divest the Church of Sweden, the state church, from the state. It no longer receives government aid for program. The members of the parish must find the money to support pastoral and musician salaries, music, etc. The government will still pay for heat, light, and maintenance, and the maintenance of the churchyard, the graveyard. And nobody knows what's coming. A delegation of pastors from the diocese of Växjö in Småland in Sweden came to Minneapolis, about a year ago it was. I had many seminars, had the opportunity to meet with them. I suspect, Gary, they were over at Luther Seminary as well, studying. You know, they wanted everything that they could find out about how the American church does it, for there is no tradition in the Nordic churches of pledges, envelopes, etc. This has been, we pay our taxes and it's looked after. So we have hiatus. No. How is it all paid for? For 60 times 5, for 293 minutes, we've been talking about one expensive Garden of Eden-esque or Nanny Nation program after another. How is it paid for? Very briefly. I would use Denmark now, which has the highest tax, 5, in order to give the sternest possible scenario here. I would say that it is paid for by an income tax, which is a huge majority of the population end up paying somewhere between 35 and 54% of their income to a national tax. Now, I asked my accountant, who incidentally has become very fascinated with this and pro bono is digging in himself into Nordic tax structure and all that sort of thing. But a bumpkin like me in retirement, I think I'd probably come in at something like 18%. Minnesota has a high state tax, but if you add my state, my federal, I'm at about 18. Probably about half the tax that I would be paying in Denmark. In addition, in the Nordic countries, when you purchase something, you don't pay a sales tax. You don't know what it's about, but the price of the product has many layers of taxation embedded into it. We call it the value-added tax, VAT. If you bought a Norwegian sweater when you were in Oslo, and you paid $200 for it, and you're told it has to be wrapped, and you have to show at the airport some slip, and you might get $30 back. That was the VAT tax, and that's the only way, only foreigners leaving the country would know exactly what happened. But I haven't got time to get into this, but just briefly, all the way through the process of manufacture of that sweater, when the buttons are purchased, or the yarn, or the dye, or the leather strip, etc., someone pays tax on that, and it's embedded into the final product. So it's more than our sales tax. In other words, the Nordics pay a lot. And then I'm going to end with Johnson's sloppy social science. By saying this, I have rarely, when had the opportunity to be at a dinner party, let's say, and that sort of thing in a Nordic country, I've noticed, I can almost predict that somewhere in the evening after schnapps and washed down with beer and that sort of thing, that the people from the host country, having someone from the United States with me, are going to say, what do you pay in taxes there? I mean, they wouldn't ask one another that, but it's very interesting to be the informant in that. But I think this maybe isn't the worst social science research. When I say that as we talk this through and who isn't interested in it, I am not sure if I'm paying more or they're paying more.
Yeah,
they're paying more in terms of their income tax. And their VAT tax is more than our sales tax. But I am paying property tax.
So
the one thing that I'm determined that I'm going to leave to my children is this is Vintage Minnesota, but it's a lake place. And boy, the county commissioners in my Lake County know who's defenseless when they see them. The owners of cabins, seasonal properties, that sort of thing. Well, it would be tacky of me to tell you what it is, but between between a condo and a cabin, well, all right, it's almost as much as my income tax. And I only know that it's going to go up and up and up, that it's regressive, even though my income will likely go down, down, and down in purchasing power. And then I thought, excuse my being personal, but the Johnson children were BBG, B for boy and G for girl, and say them in the order they arrived, and the faster you say them, the faster they arrive, BBG. And so we remember the year or two when three were in college together. And macaroni time at Johnson's. But my point is, that though in fairness, I should amortize that over my lifetime. All I know is it was one heck of a hit that Nordics wouldn't face. And all I know is that a very high proportion of students in the United States are graduating with loans that they will never be able to repay. They will just pay interest and not be able to whittle away at the principal, and then God forbid that they should marry someone with equal kind of loan problems. I think I'm talking for all of us, I have found Medicare is not covering a lot of things, and so I have a bridge plan with Blue Cross. There's $300 a month, give or take. They don't pay a dime. Well, I said, you know, you might pay a dime on the dollar for an office visit or something like that, but, and my, there is no way on God's green earth I'm going to live on my social, you know, but my social security payment. I don't see how anyone could alone. And so one invests in pension, in some sort of IRA or plan like that. And when we began, and it takes schnapps to do it, but when we began adding up at those parties, that sort of thing, I'm not sure. Plus that so much of the cost of living in our society is unpredictable. It varies. It drifts. Well, it's time for Vespers. You've been really, it's been really great experience to be able to be with you. And I hear my cell phone is good. Would you excuse me just for 1 minute? Who? This is Sig Reader Torgersen, the Prime Minister of Iceland? who the thunk? Oh, Madam Prime Minister, we're honored. The Holden Association of Nordicists is just breaking up from its annual conference. You can't mean this. We are invited. All expenses paid. To leave August 4 for a week in Iceland.
All right.
And your counterparts wish to host us as well? You said all expenses paid? But we have to fly the Iceland Air. No problem.
No problem.
No problem. See you on the 4th of August.